The headlines: Iran's top security official likens the 2015 agreement to an empty shell, ruling out any talks beyond the JCPOA due to Washington's non-compliance and Europe's inaction. Protesters in Bahrain set fire to an Israeli flag to show their anger at the Israeli Prime Minister's visit. And the pay squeeze deepening in the UK, with the annual inflation at its highest level in three decades. Our top story: the Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council says the U.S. and Europe have failed in fulfilling their obligations regarding the 2015 Iran deal. In a tweet posted a short while ago, Ali Shamkhani said, "Because of such inaction, the deal has already turned into an empty shell for Iran, both in terms of the economic benefits and the removal of sanctions." The top security official said there will be no negotiations beyond the deal with a non-compliant Washington and a passive Europe. Currently, Iran and the remaining signatories are engaged in intensive talks in Vienna to revive the accord. Iran is demanding a verifiable removal of sanctions, as well as guarantees that the deal will last beyond the current administration. Homa Lizgi is joining us now from the Austrian capital, Vienna. Homa, welcome to the program. Please bring us up to speed on the latest developments with regards to the negotiations.
Last night, we had the more negotiations between the head of Iran's team, Mr. Ali Bagheri-Kani, and EU coordinator Enrique Mora. After that, there was another meeting with the EU coordinator and representatives of the three European signatories of the JCPOA, Britain, France, and Germany. Also, yesterday, we had a meeting between the Iranian team and the IAEA Director General, Rafael Mariano Grossi. And that was, we were hearing both a discussion of latest developments when it comes to the Vienna talks and the relationship between Iran and the IAEA and the issues there. But I'd just like to give a quick overview of the most recent remarks that we're hearing being made by Iran's foreign minister, Mr. Amir Abdullahian, in an interview. And he's been talking a lot about the negotiations here. And I think some of the comments he has made are quite telling, because first of all, he said that for Iran, the issue of guarantees is the most important issue by the Americans. As a matter of principle, he said, the public opinion in Iran cannot accept just the words from the head of a state, particularly when it's the U.S., in order to be assured that the U.S. will not withdraw from the deal again, because they have the experience, of course, in 2018 with the Trump administration. So Mr. Amir Abdullahian said that he has asked his negotiators here in Vienna to convey this message to the Western parties and the U.S., saying that their parliaments, including the U.S. Congress, should, in political statements, in his words, show that they are committed and say that they and express and declare that they are committed to their obligations and that they will return to full compliance. He's also said that Iran has been getting a lot of requests from the Americans for direct talks. He did rule that out, however, saying that Iran has told the Americans that this will only be possible if the U.S. takes practical and tangible steps to show its good faith. This, for instance, he said, could include unfreezing billions of Iranian oil money that's stuck currently in foreign central banks because of the Trump sanctions, or, for instance, a presidential executive order for sanctions relief. He has said also the reason why the talks are dragging, basically, is a lack of serious initiative from the Western side. He does, however, mention that he is still optimistic about the future of these negotiations and thinks that an agreement is still possible. Now, I'll just quickly add here, speaking to sources close to the Iranian negotiating team, they have also said that one of the reasons talks are still continuing and dragging on is that some sides have been making demands that go beyond the JCPOA or Iran's commitments under the JCPOA, and this is something that Iran has rejected. And of course, this goes back to the tweet that you just mentioned there by the Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council. And these sources are telling me that the remaining issues, of course, one of them being the guarantees, if the other side makes a decision to go ahead with it and give the guarantee that's necessary for the Iranians, then an agreement will be possible. But this hasn't happened yet. That's why the talks are still continuing. earlier Iran saying that its initiatives, its recent initiatives on resolving the issues is one of the reasons why everybody thinks a deal is within sight. We'll have to see if that is going to happen.
Thanks a lot, Omar Lezgi, joining us from the Austrian capital, Vienna. Elsewhere, the Israeli Prime Minister's visit to Bahrain has caused a lot of outrage there, prompting many people to turn out and make their opposition heard. The protesters marched through the streets of the capital, Manama, and chanted slogans against the Israeli regime and in support of Palestine. They also burned the Israeli flag. Naftali Bennett's short trip to Manama marks the first such visit by an Israeli leader to Bahrain. Bennett met with Bahrain's King Hamad bin Isa Al Khalifa and the Prime Minister Crown Prince Salman bin Hamad Al Khalifa. The Israeli Prime Minister's trip coincided with the 11th anniversary of Bahraini's uprising against the Al Khalifa rulers. Bahrain normalized ties with Israel last year under a U.S. brokered deal. Well, the Bahraini uprising is still ongoing even after 11 years since it began. No matter how hard the regime has tried, whether it was banning major political opposition groups or by the total suppression of human rights, the Bahraini people mark the anniversary of the country's uprising against the Al Khalifa regime.
Bahrain has been in turmoil since a 2011 uprising backed by majority Shias demanding greater civil and political rights from the Saudi-backed monarchy. Since mid-February 2011, thousands of anti-regime protesters have held numerous demonstrations on the streets of Bahrain, calling for the family to relinquish power. Scores of Bahrainis have been killed and hundreds of others injured and arrested in an ongoing crackdown on peaceful demonstrations. Following the repression of the pro-democracy movement in February of 2011, the government of Bahrain established the Bahrain Independent Commission of Inquiry, or BICI, in July the same year. In November 2011, the BICI Commission handed over their finalized report to King Hamad bin Isa Al Khalifa. The report outlined 26 recommendations for the government of Bahrain. They addressed a number of systematic government abuses. Several recommendations addressed the lack of accountability of government authorities accused of ill treatment and torture. The BICI Commission put forth suggestions to address Bahraini courts' dismissal of judicial due process procedures and arbitrary detention of peaceful political activities. The Commission sought to address the sectarianized public security force that lacked training in the human rights dimensions of detention and interrogation. Some recommendations also sought to reinstate Bahraini workers and students after their dismissal from businesses and schools for their participation in the pro-democracy protests. However, 11 years after the beginning of Bahrain's popular uprising, the Al Khalifa regime has yet refrained from fully implementing the 26 recommendations and continues its crackdown on any form of dissent. The regime even dissolved its main opposition group, the Al-Wefaq National Islamic Society, and liquidated the group's funds back in 2016. Al-Wefaq has time and again urged international rights groups to visit the notorious Bahraini prisons and inspect the conditions of detention for the political detainees in the kingdom. Also previously, the European Center for Democracy and Human Rights had voiced concern over the deplorable condition of imprisoned Bahraini pro-democracy campaigners, warning that political dissidents and opposition figures are slowly dying in the Manama regime's jails and detention centers. The organization called for urgent action in solidarity with jailed Bahraini opposition leader and the Secretary General of the Haq Movement, Hassan Mushaima, as well as imprisoned human rights activist Abdeljalil Abdullah Al-Singas, as the pair suffer from multiple health problems, but are being denied proper health care. Also, political detainee Hossein Barakat died in captivity of Al-Khalifa regime from COVID-19 after being barred from proper medical treatment. Prominent human rights activist Abdul Hadi Al-Khawaja, who is serving a life sentence in regime prisons, as well as Nabil Rajab, who has been behind bars for criticizing the Al-Khalifa regime's involvement in the Saudi-led military campaign against Yemen, are two other detainees who have played a prominent role in the Bahraini revolution.
Actions that the regime has taken against them will continue to be opposed because the people want to be able to live in freedom and dignity. The government has not shown any receptivity toward the desires of the people.
Bahrain has come under pressure from human rights organizations over its prison conditions, including overcrowding, poor sanitation, and lack of medical care. This also includes sham trials that were held. There have been many reports of the regime's torture of detainees. Manama has gone to great lengths to clamp down on any sign of dissent.
Bahrain's top Shia cleric, Sheikh Isa Qasim, has urged people to remain united in their fight against oppression in the country. Sheikh Qasim said victory can be achieved through unity and patience. He said Bahrain needs a just and equitable constitution that recognizes people's rights, pride, and dignity. Sheikh Qasim stressed that the political conflict there can't be settled unless such a constitution is written. The Shia cleric was speaking on the anniversary of a popular uprising that began in Bahrain on March 14, 2011. Sheikh Qasim had previously urged the regime in Manama to pursue an agreement with the Bahraini opposition instead of increasingly suppressing dissent. Meanwhile, Bahraini opposition groups have called for mass participation in rallies marking the 11th anniversary of the February 14th uprising, as the Al Khalifa regime continues its heavy-handed crackdown on dissent in the Persian Gulf country. The opposition groups also stressed their faithful adherence to the principles and goals of the 2011 popular uprising stipulated in the Pearl Charter, the foremost of which are putting an end to the dictatorial tribal rule in Bahrain, establishing the right to self-determination and exposing its falsified nature before the international community.
But as we have seen for the past 11 years, they will continue to fight against these, and we can only hope that other countries will support them.
Pro-democracy protests have continued to be held in Bahrain on a regular basis ever since a popular uprising began in mid-February 2011, but the regime unleashed a harsh crackdown in response, killing many and jailing thousands. The participants demand that the Al Khalifa regime relinquish power and allow a just system representing all Bahrainis to be established.
Welcome back. The inflation rate in the United Kingdom soared to its highest in 3 decades last month. Based on new official data, the annual consumer price inflation rose to 5.5% in January. The Office for National Statistics blames the rising energy prices for contributing to the hike. The inflation is intensifying the squeeze on households and may also force the Bank of England to further raise interest rates. Earlier this month, the bank predicted that inflation will peak over 7%. In April, business and consumer groups are warning that the rise in prices would harm living standards. Saeed Pourreza is joining us now from the British capital, London. Saeed, it's great to have you with us. What do these numbers mean?
These numbers, Bardia, mean that there is a reason they're calling this year the year of this squeeze, that people's living standards are already being impacted by the rise in the inflation rate in the country. We have seen the Bank of England raise the interest rate twice already, in December and also earlier this month, and going to do the same in the coming months, especially I think the first one is going to happen in March and several more times throughout the course of the next year. The people's living standards are greatly impacted by these rises in prices. You do groceries, for example, you're paying more than you paid a few months ago only, and it's only going to get worse as we move forward. A lot of criticism against the government that is not really doing enough to offset the impact that the rise in prices is having on people's lives. Rather, they're doing to, as they say, mitigate or cushion the blow. We have seen, for example, the Chancellor of the Exchequer come out with a £200 loan that will be given to households to offset the, to cushion the blow of the impact that the energy price rise will have on British households. Come April, that 54% rise in utility bills, in energy bills in particular, come April. Add to that the rise in national insurance tax, let's say, that will also take effect in April. And let's remember also that this is a government that only a couple of years ago, I think it was pre-pandemic, said that there wouldn't be a rise in taxes for ordinary Britons, but we're seeing that happening now. And of course, they're blaming it on three things, not the government, but the economists, on a cocktail of Brexit, as well as the global increases in energy prices, as well as, well, let's call it incompetence on the part of the conservative government that has been in power since 2019. So they don't seem to be doing anything in particular that would really lighten the burden on people's finances. And we're going to see a depletion of people's savings over the coming months, the reason being that the rise in wages, for example, is not catching up with the inflation.
All right, thanks a lot. Saeed Puraz are joining us from London. Ottawa's police chief resigns amid criticism that he didn't do enough to stop prolonged anti-vax protests that have paralyzed the Canadian capital. The resignation comes as hundreds of trucks remain parked outside the Canadian Parliament. In the Prime Minister's office, Ottawa's police chief says his personnel lack resources to peacefully disperse the protesters, with his defenders voicing fears that the use of force could stoke violence. On Monday, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau invoked emergency powers to end the protests that have severely affected Canada's economy. The demonstrations were started by truckers opposing mandated COVID vaccines for crossing into the U.S. The protests later turned into a rallying point for people opposing various policies of Trudeau's government. That's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of the speech delivered on June 3, 2016, by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the occasion of 27th anniversary of Imam Khomeini's passing. The speech was delivered at Imam Khomeini's shrine in Tehran, Iran.
Our magnanimous Imam, rahmatullah alayhi, changed the direction with Iran, thus bringing about a profound transformation. He changed the path of the Iranian people. He changed the trajectory we were on, and he moved us towards lofty goals. These goals, which guided us with the help of the Imam of the Revolution, rahmatullah alayhi, and that guided the Iranian society towards the revolution, were extremely important. The sum of all these goals is the authority of God's religion. The authority of God's religion calls for social justice in the real sense of the word. It calls for uprooting poverty, ignorance, and oppression. It calls for preparing a collection of Islamic values. It calls for uprooting social detriments. It calls for providing physical, moral, and spiritual health and scientific progress for the country. It calls for offering national dignity, national and Iranian identity, and international power. It calls upon man to activate the capacities that God has given this land. All these terms are included in the authority of God's religion. It was Imam Rahmatullah Alayh who moved us towards this path. This is the exact opposite of the path towards which we were being dragged during the time of Taghut, the Pahlavi era.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
These goals towards which the train of the Islamic community moved, thanks to the revolution, are special goals that are difficult to attain. They take time, they require the passage of time, and they require endeavor. However, attaining all these goals is possible under one condition. The condition that the train should keep moving on this special track, the track of the revolution. Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi showed us the way. He showed us the standards and the criteria. He identified the goals for us. He himself began the movement.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all
fires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Bahrain has been in turmoil since a 2011 uprising backed by majority Shias demanding greater civil and political rights from the Saudi-backed monarchy. Since mid-February 2011, thousands of anti-regime protesters have held numerous demonstrations on the streets of Bahrain, calling for the family to relinquish power. Scores of Bahrainis have been killed and hundreds of others injured and arrested in an ongoing crackdown on peaceful demonstrations. Following the repression of the pro-democracy movement in February of 2011, the government of Bahrain established the Bahrain Independent Commission of Inquiry, or BICI, in July the same year. In November 2011, the BICI Commission handed over their finalized report to King Hamad bin Isa Al Khalifa. The report outlined 26 recommendations for the government of Bahrain. They addressed a number of systematic government abuses. Several recommendations addressed the lack of accountability of government authorities accused of ill treatment and torture. The BICI Commission put forth suggestions to address Bahraini courts' dismissal of judicial due process procedures and arbitrary detention of peaceful political activities. The Commission sought to address the sectarianized public security force that lacked training in the human rights dimensions of detention and interrogation. Some recommendations also sought to reinstate Bahraini workers and students after their dismissal from businesses and schools for their participation in the pro-democracy protests. However, 11 years after the beginning of Bahrain's popular uprising, the Al Khalifa regime has yet refrained from fully implementing the 26 recommendations and continues its crackdown on any form of dissent. The regime even dissolved its main opposition group, the Al Wefaq National Islamic Society, and liquidated the group's funds back in 2016. Al-Wefaq has time and again urged international rights groups to visit the notorious Bahraini prisons and inspect the conditions of detention for the political detainees in the kingdom. Also previously, the European Center for Democracy and Human Rights had voiced concern over the deplorable condition of imprisoned Bahraini pro-democracy campaigners, warning that political dissidents and opposition figures are slowly dying in the Manama regime's jails and detention centers. The organization called for urgent action in solidarity with jailed Bahraini opposition leader and the Secretary General of the Haq Movement, Hassan Mashaima, as well as imprisoned human rights activist Abdeljalil Abdullah Al-Singas, as the pair suffer from multiple health problems but are being denied proper health care. Also, political detainee Hossein Barakat died in captivity of Al-Khalifa regime from COVID-19 after being barred from proper medical treatment. Prominent human rights activist Abdulhadi Al-Khawaja, who is serving a life sentence in regime prisons, as well as Nabil Rajab, who has been behind bars for criticizing the Al-Khalifa regime's involvement in the Saudi-led military campaign against Yemen, are two other detainees who have played a prominent role in the Bahraini revolution. Bahrain's top Shia cleric, Sheikh Isa Qasim, has urged people to remain united in their fight against oppression in the country. Sheikh Qasim said victory can be achieved through unity and patience. He said Bahrain needs a just and equitable constitution that recognizes people's rights, pride, and dignity. Sheikh Qasim stressed that the political conflict there can't be settled unless such a constitution is written. The Shia cleric was speaking on the anniversary of a popular uprising that began in Bahrain on March 14, 2011. Sheikh Qasim had previously urged the regime in Manama to pursue an agreement with the Bahraini opposition instead of increasingly suppressing dissent. Meanwhile, Bahraini opposition groups have called for mass participation in rallies marking the 11th anniversary of the February 14th uprising, as the Al Khalifa regime continues its heavy-handed crackdown on dissent in the Persian Gulf country. The opposition groups also stressed their faithful adherence to the principles and goals of the 2011 popular uprising stipulated in the Pearl Charter, the foremost of which are putting an end to the dictatorial tribal rule in Bahrain, establishing the right to self-determination and exposing its falsified nature before the international community. Pro-democracy protests have continued to be held in Bahrain on a regular basis ever since a popular uprising began in mid-February 2011, but the regime unleashed a harsh crackdown in response, killing many and jailing thousands. The participants demand that the Al Khalifa regime relinquish power and allow a just system representing all Bahrainis to be established.
As the Saudi war in Yemen rages on, clashes and cross-border strikes have escalated in the past few weeks. The Yemeni army has conducted several strikes on targets deep inside the United Arab Emirates in response to what it calls the Sheikhdom's complicity in the crimes committed against the people of Yemen. Sana'a has promised to continue the cross-border strikes until the blockade on Yemen is lifted and the war on the country is ended. But how is the UAE involved in the war? The country has been supporting the so-called Southern Transitional Council separatists in southern Yemen since at least 2018. Those are the mercenaries that took control of Yemen's resource-rich Socotra Island in 2020. This move was a departure from its coalition partner, Saudi Arabia, who is only interested in keeping the Yemeni army away from its border. But the UAE has shown interest in controlling the port of Aden as well. Its focus is to have control over the important waterway, the Bab al-Mandab, an important oil shipping route.
Clearly, that's exactly the intention and the reason that Israel is involved is partly because that also means that they have at least the tacit approval of the United States as well. So they think that the UAE thinks that this is the way that they will be able to control this sea route. And they're also building a base on the island of Perim, or Mayum, as it's called, just off the coast of Taiz in Yemen. And it's actually, this is also Yemeni territory. But it's right in the middle of the Bab al-Mandab. It's right in the middle of the routes of 20,000 ships that pass through the Red Sea and the Suez Canal.
The Yemeni army has in recent weeks been fighting and liberating land from the separatists in the provinces of Shabwa and Marib. The UAE is Saudi Arabia's main partner in the years-long war that Riyadh and its allies have been waging against Yemen to change the impoverished country's ruling structure. The military campaign has killed hundreds of thousands of Yemenis and turned the entire Yemen into the scene of what the United Nations calls the world's worst humanitarian crisis. The onslaught enjoys American military, logistical, and political support. The UAE is one of the most advanced air defense systems in the Persian Gulf region, but they haven't been quite successful at stopping the Yemeni army's missiles and drones. The Emiratis are now looking at South Korea, Israel, and France to supply them with additional weaponry and ammunition. In its largest arms export deal in history, South Korea agreed with the UAE to sell $3.5 billion worth of Cheongung II advanced medium-range surface-to-air missiles, along with accompanying radars. Abu Dhabi is also in talks with Tel Aviv to buy its missile system dubbed the Iron Dome. The UAE is also eyeing purchasing either Israel's Barak 8 or Spider missile systems. The systems will be installed in addition to American-made THAAD air defense batteries. And all of this comes in the backdrop of the U.S. playing a more prominent role by sending an aircraft carrier and fighter jets to the UAE. In one recent attack by the Yemeni army, the U.S. shot down the Yemeni army missiles. What does all this signal? Will this mean that the Emirates is bent on pressing ahead with its aggression against Yemen, despite the obvious losses of its mercenaries on the ground in the war-ravaged country? And the U.S., along with Israel, have promised support.
The UAE had its own goals in Yemen, which were not the same as those of Saudi Arabia. But they could only happen. The UAE could only fulfill its goals in South Yemen if there was the Saudi Arabia succeeded in its goals in northern Yemen. That is, Yemen had to be torn apart and split between Saudi Arabian influence and UAE influence.
At any rate, the Yemeni army is vowed to continue to pound targets deep inside Saudi Arabia and the UAE until the war is over. The Yemenis are warning that the Emirates and its trade-based economy won't be able to withstand the attacks. As the Saudi war in Yemen rages on, clashes and cross-border strikes have escalated in the past few weeks. The Yemeni army has conducted several strikes on targets deep inside the United Arab Emirates in response to what it calls the Sheikhdom's complicity in the crimes committed against the people of Yemen. Sana'a has promised to continue the cross-border strikes until the blockade on Yemen is lifted and the war on the country is ended. But how is the UAE involved in the war? The country has been supporting the so-called Southern Transitional Council separatists in southern Yemen since at least 2018. Those are the mercenaries that took control of Yemen's resource-rich Socotra Island in 2020. This move was a departure from its coalition partner, Saudi Arabia, who is only interested in keeping the Yemeni army away from its border. But the UAE has shown interest in controlling the port of Aden as well. Its focus is to have control over the important waterway, the Bab al-Mandab, an important oil shipping route.
Clearly, that's exactly the intention and the reason that Israel and is involved is partly because that also means that they have at least the approval, the tacit approval of the United States as well. So they think that the UAE thinks that this is the way that they will be able to control this sea route. They're also building a base on the island of Perim, or Mayum, as it's called, just off the coast of Taiz in Yemen. And it's actually, this is also Yemeni territory. But it's right in the middle of the Bab al-Mandab. It's right middle of the routes of 20,000 ships that pass through the Red Sea and the Suez Canal.
The Yemeni army has in recent weeks been fighting and liberating land from the separatists in the provinces of Shabwa and Marib. The UAE is Saudi Arabia's main partner in the years-long war that Riyadh and its allies have been waging against Yemen to change the impoverished country's ruling structure. The military campaign has killed hundreds of thousands of Yemenis and turned the entire Yemen into the scene of what the United Nations calls the world's worst humanitarian crisis. The onslaught enjoys American military, logistical, and political support. The UAE is one of the most advanced air defense systems in the Persian Gulf region, but they haven't been quite successful at stopping the Yemeni army's missiles and drones. The Emiratis are now looking at South Korea, Israel, and France to supply them with additional weaponry and ammunition. In its largest arms export deal in history, South Korea agreed with the UAE to sell $3.5 billion worth of Cheongung II advanced medium-range surface-to-air missiles, along with accompanying radars. Abu Dhabi is also in talks with Tel Aviv to buy its missile system dubbed the Iron Dome. The UAE is also eyeing purchasing either Israel's Barak 8 or Spider missile systems. The systems will be installed in addition to American-made THAAD air defense batteries. And all of this comes in the backdrop of the U.S. playing a more prominent role by sending an aircraft carrier and fighter jets to the UAE. In one recent attack by the Yemeni army, the U.S. shot down the Yemeni army missiles. What does all this signal? Will this mean that the Emirates is bent on pressing ahead with its aggression against Yemen, despite the obvious losses of its mercenaries on the ground in the war-ravaged country? And the U.S., along with Israel, have promised support.
The UAE had its own goals in Yemen, which were not the same as those of Saudi Arabia. But they could only happen. The UAE could only fulfill its goals in South Yemen if there was, the Saudi Arabia succeeded in its goals in northern Yemen. That is, Yemen had to be torn apart and split between Saudi Arabian influence and UAE influence.
At any rate, the Yemeni army has vowed to continue to pound targets deep inside Saudi Arabia and the UAE until the war is over. The Yemenis are warning that the Emirates and its trade-based economy won't be able to withstand the attacks.
Meet the latest addition to Iran's diverse missile arsenal, Khaybar Shekan, a state-of-the-art missile unveiled earlier this week. It can strike its targets within a range of 1,450 kilometers with pinpoint precision. The ballistic missile is solid-fueled and therefore will be ready for launch much faster than liquid-fueled projectiles. It's even much faster and lighter than other Iranian solid-fueled models and can carry a powerful warhead. Ballistic missiles fly up into outer space before returning to hit their targets with a somehow predictable trajectory. This makes them vulnerable to interception by air defense systems. But Iran's armed forces say Khaybar Shekan boasts high maneuverability when it dives down, making it a nightmare for any advanced missile shield. Iran has been manufacturing various types of military equipment and weapons, including missiles, despite many rounds of Western sanctions against its arms industry and other sectors. Missiles are one of the cornerstones of Iran's defense doctrine. Iran has the Middle East's most diverse arsenal of projectiles, from very short-range rockets to advanced ballistic and cruise missiles with pinpoint capabilities. Iran has been working hard to enhance them, both in terms of range and precision.
Iran is merely trying to keep up in order to defend itself. I mean, I'm sure Iran and the Islamic Revolution would like to spend that money elsewhere. But as long as you're being threatened, it is necessary to develop yourself to a degree in order to be able to have that defense. Now, you can have all the greatness that you want, but if you're not capable of defending it, you'll eventually lose it.
The Iranian pursuit of more advanced projectiles has been relentless. It makes no secret of it, because Tehran says they are a must for effective defense in the world's most dangerous region. But how did Iran master the technology to produce advanced projectiles despite decades of sanctions and import bans imposed by the West? The Iranian missile program grew out of the war initiated by the Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein in the 1980s. Saddam's forces showered Iranian cities with missiles and bombs provided by the East and the West, while Iranians say no one sold them any proper means of defense. Iranians argue that they had no choice but building their own defense industry domestically and independently. The latest Iranian achievements are a far cry from the earliest models. Meanwhile, the West, especially the United States and its close allies, have described Iran's missile arsenal as a threat. They have tried to push Iran to abandon it, but Iranians seem to have learned to listen from the past and insist that their defensive missile power is a red line that will never be negotiated.
There has been a great deal of growing hostility towards Iran from the imperialist powers, and that in doing so, they have forced Iran to develop greater and greater weapons with the capacity to defend themselves. They are under assault from imperialism, and this is a constant ongoing threat from the United States, Israel, and Saudi Arabia, who have formed the imperialist bloc inside of the Middle East.
When repeated Israeli threats against Iran are taken into account, the need for a robust defense program seems more urgent. Iran says its military might will enhance regional security. It also insists that it will never start a war, but if attacked, a crushing response will definitely follow.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio.
log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
Seventh Imam, Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salatu wa salam, is actually known as Bab al-Hawaij.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام خير الأمور أوسطها.
Ziyarah of Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kazim alayhi salam.
As-salamu alayka ya Mawlai Musa ibn Ja'far wa rahmatullah.
This is Dialogue, a program on the famous conversations of Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome, dear listeners, and I'm your host, Mahdi. We're talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Kazim alayhi salam. Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was also the seventh divinely appointed Imam among the household of the Holy Prophet Muhammad. Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam led a life which was in balance and harmony with that of the Prophet Muhammad, his great-great-grandfather. His life and the life of Imam al-Kazim was in the line and the direction of the Prophet Muhammad. And of course, the life of Imam al-Kazim alayhi salam was a strict adherence and obedience of Islam in so many different ways, whether it was his ethics, his morals, his behaviors, his actions, his statements. We find that Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam was the copy of the Holy Prophet Muhammad of Islam, the messenger of Allah. Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam led an upright, righteous, and noble life. These are his dialogues.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام ما تساب اثنان إلا انحط الأعلى إلى مرتبة الأسفل.
Imam al-Kazim alayhi salam stated, whenever two people insult each other, the more superior of the two sinks to the level of the more inferior one.
Thank you.
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's a blessing to have you with us on the program. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. So we're talking about these beautiful conversations that the infallible imams had with their companions and their friends and their relatives. In these few episodes, we are specifically talking about the conversations and the dialogues of the esteemed His Eminence, Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kadhim, alayhi salam. We find that in one of these conversations with his companions, Imam al-Kadhim, alayhi salam, talks about moderation. It's interesting, sometimes we think that moderation is something that is difficult, or moderation is something that has no results or rewards, when in reality we are taught the opposite by the infallible imams and the Holy Prophet, peace and blessings upon him and his holy household. And so along these lines, we find that Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam, in a conversation with his companions, says to them that whoever is moderate never becomes poor. Now, such a beautiful point which is brought up in this conversation by Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam, that if you are moderate, you will not become poor. It is so interesting that in this very consumeristic and materialistic life, which is practically forced upon us because there's a lot of money to be made in this consumeristic, materialistic, endless chain. And without the consumer, then people won't make money. So this is forced upon us to buy endlessly and to have endless greed and to continue being a consumer in this cycle. And you will find that a lot of these people, they are not wealthy. They don't have savings. They don't have money in store for a rainy day. Why? Because they were either wasteful or they were extravagant. Whereas Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam here tells us that whoever is moderate never becomes poor, living within one's means. And it's interesting if we go a little bit further, surely among the features of Islamic economics and the Islamic economic model is the prevention of extravagance, the prevention of wastefulness. For extravagance and wastefulness brings about the loss of positions on an individual and societal level. It also brings about the corruption in the morals, again on an individual and societal level. And finally, it also spreads this relaxation when it comes to morals, this not giving due diligence to morals, and creates negative traits also on the individual and societal levels. So as Imam al-Kadhim says, whoever is moderate never becomes poor. This is Dialogue, Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Now let's listen to Brother Muhammad Al-Hilli, who's going to talk about today's topic.
Imam Musa ibn Ja'far, the principles and the values by which he established during his lifetime are truly ones that should be disseminated and spread in order for others to reap the fruits of his teachings and his illustrious life. The title that he is given is Al-Kadhim. In Arabic, Kadhim comes from Kadhm. Kadhm is a term that the Arabs used to use when they fill a water container. Then they seal it to the extent that no water drips out from the tip of the container. It highlights a wonderful characteristic and a moral principle. known as restraint and forbearance at the time of anger and displeasure. Allah tabaraka wa ta'ala in Surah Ali Imran, chapter 3, verse 134 says, الَّذِينَ يُنْفِقُونَ فِي السَّرَّاءِ وَالضَّرَّاءِ. There are those who give at times of happiness and at times of difficulty. وَالْكَاظِمِينَ الْغَيْظِ. Those who swallow their anger. وَالْعَافِينَ عَنِ النَّاسِ. Not only do they swallow their anger, they forgive the people. وَاللَّهُ يُحِبُّ الْمُحْسِنِينَ. And Allah loves the good doers. Imam alayhi salam emerged with this title because during his time there was widespread oppression and injustice against the followers of Ali Muhammad. And yet he would reciprocate this with kindness, with generosity, with the principles of akhlaq, making him the walking Quran.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to visit our website at farstoday.com/en, Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many others as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
Travelers who never arrived at their destination. The Persian Gulf, near the Strait of Hormuz, 7:45 a.m., July 3rd, 1988. One of the helicopters of the U.S. cruiser, Vincennes, reports that Iranian boats are hovering around a German cargo vessel. The Vincennes cruiser moves quickly towards the German cargo vessel without being asked.
We remain alert and we'll stay alert. But at the same time, I don't want to ever give the impression that we're leaning forward on our toes to get a major conflagration started here. That's not the case at all.
The war that the Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein started on the last day of the summer of 1980 against Iran entered its eighth year. Throughout these years, the Iranians wanted to put an end to the war through winning the land war. From the second year of the war onwards, they had been always far superior to the Iraqi army on the battlefield after being surprised by the beginning of the war. Operation Karbala 5 took place in early 1987. At the end of the bloody Operation Karbala 5, Iran had a superior position and was able to penetrate through the defensive line of Shalamche. The progress of Iranian forces towards Basra resulted in significant outcomes. The United States sent the aircraft carrier USS John F. Kennedy to the Persian Gulf to prevent the defeat of Iraq and the fall of Basra. Die Welt and Spiegel wrote that the United States was ready to fight